All right, welcome everyone to the MSU Libraries. It's so good to see all of you here together. And my name's Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with Jewish studies and Muslim studies and anthropology, Middle East area studies. And this is our final event in our symposium on modern Hebrew and Israeli literature. And it's been such a pleasure to learn with you, and we will together tonight again. And a real honor to have Robert Alter here with us. I wanted to really thank our various librarians and library units that helped on this. Our public relations coordinator, Ruth Ann Jones, who's here tonight, and our graphic designer and our digital media center, and John Shaw. Thank you so much for your support. Next, I'm going to introduce Ken Walzer. Ken is the director of the MSU Jewish Studies program, and he's also a professor in James Madison College and historian. And it's been wonderful working with you, and will continue to be so. Ken Walzer.
I'm pleased to welcome many of you back for a second night, which is really nice. I want to say thank you, while I still remember it, to all the participants today who gave us a wonderful day of papers and exchanges. We've been scrambling a little bit the last little bit, but Mark has somehow arranged Delta to get up and fly straight. So we've got all our connections made. We put this program together with a planning committee. A lot of people participated. I want to thank all of them. People in the Jewish Studies staff office spent a lot of time running down details. I want to thank them. But most of all, I want to thank Mark Bernstein, who is the chair of the planning committee. We had weekly meetings for many months to go over the details of this, many movable parts in this, and somehow we have been able to pull it all off. In the process, Mark set an all-time record for numbers of emails per day. We are here, and I'm going to turn it over to Mark, who is head of our and coordinator of our Hebrew program. He's a professor of Hebrew culture. His specialty is Judeo-Arab studies. He studies the movement of stories back and forth across traditions. And it's been a pleasure working with him on this project. Mark.
Thank you again for coming out for a second night. And again, the weather has not been so cooperative, but it's very nice to see you all here. It's very happy to run what we think has been a very successful symposium. Started out last night with our author keynote by Meir Shalev, which was wonderful. And today we had an amazing set of very diverse but fascinating and provocative speakers throughout our three panels during the day. And to conclude, we are very proud to have be able to have brought in Robert Alter. Many of you know Robert Alter's work as a translator of the Bible, but also as a critic, a literary critic of both French, German, but primarily Hebrew literature. And that's why we were especially happy to have him come out to take part in our symposium. Let me just say, in terms of the plan, Professor Alter will speak for the next hour or so. There'll be a question and answer, and then we will have a reception afterwards. We'll be all the participants in the symposium will be around and available to speak with you, and Professor Alter will be here as well. Let me just say, in terms of, I mentioned this today in our sessions, but this was Steve Weiland's inspired idea to change the title of our confab from a conference to a symposium. And I forgot to mention earlier today was that the serendipitous nature of this is that we just came through the Pesach holiday, the Passover holiday, where the whole idea is to have a symposium, a scholarly discussion over wine and food. And similarly, this has been a wonderful event for us in terms of intellectual stimulation, but coupled with good food, good friends, and good drink even. as just symposium, as I mentioned today, means the Greek meaning is just to drink together. And it was, of course, a key Hellenic social institution. It was this was at a different time when it was primarily for free men to debate, plot, boast, or just have a good time with others. And it was often held to introduce young men into aristocratic society. Typically, the symposia would be held in the andron, the men's quarters of the household. The participants, or symposiasts, would recline on pillowed couches. This might sound familiar from the Passover Seder. You would recline on pillowed couches arrayed against three walls of the room, the walls away from the door. And typically, you have 7 to 9 people on a couch. And so the total number of people would be about 14 to 27. And just the reason food and wine were a major part of the entertainment for the evening. And as I said, drinking was a major component. And in fact, the symposiarch, which I guess is my title, the symposiarch would decide how strong to make the wine for the evening, depending on whether serious discussions were to ensue or just merely sensual indulgence was to be the evening's event. In any case, we're very happy to have put on this symposium, as I mentioned, and looking forward to a very fascinating talk by Professor Alter. Professor Alter is a longtime professor he's a longtime professor at UC Berkeley, is now professor in the Graduate School and Emeritus Professor of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at UC Berkeley, where he has taught since 1967. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, the Council of Scholars of the Library of Congress, and past president of the Association of Literary Scholars and Critics. He has 24, going on I guess 25, published works, including 2 prize-winning volumes on biblical narrative and poetry, and translations of Genesis, the 5 books of Moses, wisdom literature, wisdom books, in addition to more general works on Sholem, Binyamin, and Kafka, the David story, a translation of and commentary on 1 and 2 Samuel, and his works in modern Hebrew literature have dealt with both the process of the revival of modern Hebrew prose in the modern period, as well as general works on and scholarly articles on many different authors in the that have been part of the revived Hebrew tradition. Again, it's my great honor to welcome my former teacher, my teacher still to this day, Professor Robert Alter. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. I have to say, this is my second talk today, and I think in the past I may have given 2 talks in one day, but not 2 talks on 2 totally different subjects. And I feel a little bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That is, this morning was my Dr. Jekyll presence, where I was the kindly family physician, and I spoke in this friendly, informal way from notes, and as someone said to me afterwards, smiled a lot. and now it's Mr. Hyde. I have a hard polished prepared text the way academic people do, which I am going to present to you. I feel obliged to begin by explaining a point of literary culture that will be self-evident to any literate Hebrew reader, but that may be a little perplexing to anybody else. The Bible, though standing at a remove of 2.5 to 3 millennia from the contemporary world, remains a potent presence in Hebrew poetry. Perhaps the closest analogy in English would be Shakespeare, though there is, I think, a difference at least in degree. Admittedly, biblical literacy in Israel, and therefore engagement in the Bible, are not what they once were. But the Bible is still the strong and perennially relevant foundation on which subsequent strata of Hebrew expression have been constructed. There are obviously many Hebrew poets now, minimalist or otherwise, who avoid any reference to the Bible, but one suspects that it takes a certain conscious resolve to do so. It is hard writing in Hebrew to think about outrageous or unreasonable sacrifice without referring to the binding of Isaac, to contemplate the futility of human endeavor without alluding to Kohelet, to Ecclesiastes, to celebrate the joy of erotic experience without recalling the Song of Songs, to confront the manifest injustice of the world order and its terrible toll of undeserved suffering without invoking Job. A literary person in Israel, of course, may be moved by all sorts of writers, and indeed they have been, outside the framework of Hebrew tradition, from Homer to Proust and Faulkner. But accessible in his or her own language are the Psalms, the great narrative of David, the poetry of Isaiah, and much else, all of which is as good as it gets, I think, in any literature. I know that Meir Shalev and I are entirely in agreement on this question. There are, one must concede, some hindrances, but for the most part only minor ones to the linguistic accessibility. I would say that the distance between the language of the Bible and modern Hebrew is roughly like that between Elizabethan and modern English, although perhaps the gap is beginning to widen. There is a vast wealth of vocabulary that the language has acquired after the Bible, from the rabbinic period to the day before yesterday. The grammar is a little different, and some biblical words have changed in meaning. The verb, for example, that in modern Hebrew means to think, in the Bible means to plan or to devise. So a contemporary reader could misconstrue certain statements, just as a contemporary English reader might think that meat, M-E-A-T, in Shakespeare was something bought from a butcher and not a general word for food. Notwithstanding such bits of static in the transmission of the biblical language to the modern ear, a Hebrew poet in the 20th or even in the 21st century can read, say, the sublime celebration of creation that is Psalm 8, or the somber, mesmerizing prose poem that begins Ecclesiastes, and be immediately moved by its language, perhaps even drawn to use it in some way. It is instructive that the generation of Hebrew poets who became active in the 1950s, though they had agendas that perhaps might have led them away from the Bible, reverted to it with surprising frequency. This is true of Natan Zach, whose role in the literary scene I'll explain momentarily. It's true of Dalia Ravakovich. It is true early and late of Yehuda Amichai, who at the end of his career devoted a whole section of his last volume of poetry to contending with the Bible. That's Tanakh. Natan Zach has long been a cultural eminence in Israel. In one of the poems we'll look at, he even describes himself as having been enlisted, despite himself, as a national prophet. But he's relatively unfamiliar as a figure elsewhere, so a few words of introduction are in order. He was born in Berlin in 1930 and came with his parents to Palestine in 1935. It's an odd coincidence, strictly, I think, the product of the historical circumstances of those years, that is, the years following 1933, that three of the leading poets of this generation, Zach, Amichai, and Dan Pagis, were all native speakers of German. At the beginning of the 1950s, Zach was part of a small group of young poets self-designated as Likrat, which means approximately toward in Hebrew, that aimed to bring about a revolution in Hebrew verse. The poets who had been dominant in the 1930s and 1940s characteristically cultivated a high literary Hebrew, often exhibiting ingenious linguistic artifice and favored metrically regular rhyming forms influenced by Russian models. The Leclap poets, by contrast, enamored of Anglo-American modernist verse, aspired to make Hebrew poetry colloquial, in touch with the sounds and rhythms and lexicon of everyday life, in modes that were understated and ironic rather than rhetorical. Zach's role in Likrat and in the years after its brief lifespan was that of a literary ideologue, sometimes excoriating the poets of the previous generation. His attack on Nathan Alterman is well known. Sometimes, also articulating a poetic agenda. He seems to have aspired to be a kind of Ezra Pound for his fellow modernizing poets, and even claimed, against all evidence, as far as I can see, to have been the mentor in style of Yehuda Amichai, who would prove to be by far the greatest poet to emerge from this group. Zach himself has been a prolific poet over the years. His collected works take up three large volumes, but it is my candid opinion that much of the poetry, perhaps even most of it, is rather mediocre. Some of his poems, like many of Amichai's, have entered Israeli popular culture by being set to music, but most of his poetic production strikes me as uninspired, more self-consciously willed than poetically imagined. In my view, he's been more a figure in Israeli poetry than a poet of the first order. But his engagement with the Bible has generated several of his most deeply interesting poems. It may not be an entirely anticipated engagement in a poet who advocated a vernacular idiom and sought to follow the path of T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and W.H. Auden. Unlike Amichai, whose relation to the Bible is usually expressed through allusion and sometimes a kind of creative exegesis, often pointedly heterodox, Zach is more drawn to rewriting the biblical text as a mode of personal expression. The three poems on Job that I would like to consider manifest three rather different ways of treating the biblical materials. And what I'm going to do is, all these translations are mine. I'll read in Hebrew the last two of the four poems I'm going to deal with, because they're quite short. I know that there are quite a few Hebrew speakers in the audience. For Job, it was a one-time thing, carries out a strategy that has often been employed by the Anglo-American modernists in relating their work to classical texts. One might think of Eliot's Sweeney Among the Nightingales. Aeschylus's Agamemnon is invoked in the Greek epigraph and in the body of the poem in the last stanza. But in the poem, the high dignity of Greek tragedy has been reduced to vulgar figures in a sordid setting, some kind of cheap pub. And Clytemnestra's modern avatar, Rachel, née Rabinowitz, is an animalistic creature that, quote, tears at the grapes with murderous paws. The anti-Semitic innuendo is part of the contrast Eliot intends between lofty Greek tragedy and a fallen modern reality infested by vile Jews. I mean, he made no bones about his anti-Semitism. I can't resist a little anecdote. Years ago, I got a letter from a neurologist in Tel Aviv after I'd written an article on T.S. Eliot and the Jews. And he sent me, this is before Xerox, photocopies of two letters he got from T.S. Eliot. He had sent T.S. Eliot a German translation of Sweeney and the Nightingales. And he said, I translated this because I think it's a brilliant poem. And the fact that it's anti-Semitic didn't bother me. And of course, many of my patients here in Tel Aviv are named Rabinowitz. So Eliot wrote back, I'm glad you translated the poem. And to the best of my judgment of German, it's a good translation. But I'm surprised he would ascribe anything like anti-Semitism to me. Poor Ezra is another case, you know, Ezra Pound, of course. He says, as to the name Rabinowitz, I chose it as I chose the names of all the figures in my poems for its euphony. Okay, back to Natan Zach. In Zach's poem, the aggressively colloquial diction reflecting the speaker's modern, very post-biblical location is flaunted from beginning to end. And I'll read the poem, and I think you have it in a handout. For Job, it was a one-time thing. While he was yet speaking, there came also another. First the cattle, then the camels, and then the sons and the daughters. What can you say? Good, healthy blows. Then came the eternal debates, the claims and the blames and the promises. For me, it's not so dramatic. A tiny blow in the morning, sometimes just a slap or an accidental tap, sometimes even a glitch, not divine, and a little bruise, sometimes a black eye or just sight problems, or forms, or a landlord, work or letters, a wife in the evening. And on Friday, two blows to pay your dues. And on Saturday, you rest and recover. Once I was in another land where no one knew my name. And God and the adversary didn't compete over my righteousness. And altogether, nobody made a fuss. No breach and no shouting. And it was a bit boring, but wonderful. And everything was okay, but not as it should be. And I returned to my place, and look, I'm a prophet, a nationalized Job chick, kicking and screaming, me. The italicized phrases are quotations from the Bible. The italicized second line, of course, is a quotation of the report of the messengers who bear ill tidings in the frame story of Job. Everything else in the language of the poem, with just one additional exception, the other italicized phrase, is flaunted vernacular. The flaunting begins with the very first word of the poem, Etzel, which is slightly lower in register than my English equivalent for, and reflects a colloquial usage that derives from the homey Yiddish bai. The same register, of course, is manifested in a one-time thing, chad pa'ami. The opening line also nicely articulates a sharp contrast between two different orders of time. Job, a figure in a memorable literary narrative, moves through the linear time of a clear-cut plot in which one thing follows another until a resolution, which has satisfied nobody, is finally achieved. His dreadful suffering occurs in a quick sequence of catastrophic events, triggering his debate with the three comforters, and then is reversed in the restoration of his fortunes at the end. For the speaker of the poem, on the other hand, misery is both habitual and trivial, and time is a cycle of banal repetitions. Instead of a catastrophic blow, in the Bible, makkah often implies lethal force and is also a term used for plague. What he gets is a makonet, a blow with a diminutive suffix, represented in my translation as tiny blow because of the difficulty in English with diminutive endings. The suffering of Job's modern counterpart is a matter of routine. an annoying bump here or there, site problems, landlords, filling out forms, domestic difficulties. The generalized modern ordinary man of the first two verse paragraphs becomes explicitly autobiographical in the last verse paragraph. Zach is no doubt alluding to his extended stay in England in the 1960s, some of it in the provinces. There he enjoyed the comfort of anonymity, entirely off the stage of cosmic drama where Job's fate was played out, and also off the stage of Israeli culture. In this setting, nobody made a fuss, more literally bothered, hitrid. And in the poem's other biblical citation, there was no breach and no shouting, which is from Psalm 144. Not to be the object of divine or human attention was obviously something of a relief, but also left the speaker with a sense of lack of reality. Everything was okay, but was not as it should be. The place to which he returns is, of course, Israel, where he finds himself as a recognized cultural figure and a kind of prophet despite himself, a nationalized Jobchik. Not Job with his one-time suffering etched in narrative, but a Job with a comic diminutive suffix, a pygmy Job whose pain is devoid of dignity or drama. The biblical Job is an exemplary figure of human suffering. His diminished modern counterpart, dragged by the heels into the public arena, merely wants to be himself, to be left alone with his petty miseries, bearing no message, prophetic or otherwise, simply yelling, "Me, me." The second Zach poem I'd like to consider, Sometimes He Misses. Oh, thank you. Good idea. So the poem entitled Sometimes He Misses, Lefamim Mitgagea, does not trace the familiar modernist antithesis between contemporary reality and a foundational text, but instead expresses a relation to the biblical story that one might call midrashic. In keeping with this aim, the language of the poem is not flaunted colloquial like that of For Job It Was a One-Time Thing, but instead exhibits a kind of modern middle diction, more literary than vernacular, in which the bits of biblical citation and echoes are seamlessly integrated instead of standing out in sharp contrast. It's worth noting that the biblical intertext for this poem is exclusively the frame story of Job, not the debate and complaint against God that make it up the poetic body of the book. So here is Sometimes He Misses on your handout. Sometimes God misses his sweet servant Job, but he's dead. Job is now far from God as from other things, angels. What should God do? He's reading, believe it or not, in Psalms. He still doesn't know it by heart. And the words there are so soothing, so many poems, a great and wide sea, and numberless beasts, great and small, and trees, lots of trees, and always water. There is no darkness nor shadow of death, he recites to himself in a faint voice. And then remember something in loving rebuke. God is already weeping, refusing to be consoled. He has no consolation for his sweet servant Job, the sweetest of servants, each of whose eyeballs was like an Eden. There's been none like his servant Job to this day in all times. All recall that in the frame story, God repeatedly refers to Job with pride and satisfaction as my servant Job, Avdi Iyov. both in his exchanges with the adversary at the beginning and in his affirmation of Job's righteousness at the end. Yet the God of the biblical story remains a remote and rather enigmatic figure. If he is so pleased with his devoted servant, why does he agree to the perverse wager that the adversary proposes? What does he feel about the hideous chain of afflictions that the man he supposedly values is made to undergo? Biblical narrative in general famously abounds in unexplained gaps, a trait spectacularly evident in the frame story of Job. One of the characteristic operations of Midrash is to fill in those gaps, offering explanation and motivation where none is provided, fleshing out what is left unstated in the biblical text. In Zach's poem, the process of filling in the gaps begins when the seemingly unfeeling God of the biblical tale is said at the outset to miss or long for, the mitgagea, Job. And then in the next line, he adds to the biblical epithet, my servant Job, the adjective sweet. And of course, notoriously, biblical writers avoid such adjectives. It's not an adjectival prose, and especially attitudinal adjectives like this are seriously suppressed. An implicit problem in the biblical book is the immense distance between God and Job. The Zelda poem, as we'll see, highlights this feature. Determinations about Job's fate are made in the celestial assembly far above him, of which he cannot have the slightest inkling. And in the poetic body of the book, God does not answer any of Job's complaints and accusations until the thundering speech from the whirlwind, which is hardly an intimate response. The God of Zach's poem does not express remorse or sorrow over Job's sufferings. In fact, the whole business of the wager seems to be eliminated in this poem, but rather a painful regret that Job has died, as all men must. God, it seems, has missed an opportunity, as most of us do in our loving relationships. When Job was with him, he could have been close to his sweet servant, but on the evidence of the biblical text, he failed to do that. Now Job is gone, and God, who for better or for worse is immortal, struggles to come to terms with the loss. The fitting and also amusing source of consolation he seeks is Psalms, another of those books he has inspired, though he confesses that he does not yet know it by heart. At this point, the poem glides smoothly into quotation and reminiscence of the biblical book in question. God reads a verse from the great panoramic ode to creation that is Psalm 104. In the King James version of verse 24, the one cited here, this great and wide sea wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beasts. Perhaps if he can no longer enjoy the presence of Job, he can at least contemplate the teeming riches of the wonderful creation he has made. The many trees invoked recall the trees of the forest that in other psalms sing out joyously, and of course the tree by that is the righteous man in Psalm 1, and the water alludes to the streams of water by which the flourishing tree of the righteous is planted in that psalm, and to the repeated references to the breakers of the sea over which God holds sway. The concluding verse paragraph begins with a quotation not from the book of Psalms that God has been reading, but from Job 34, verse 22. There is no darkness nor shadow of death. In a strategy not uncommon to rabbinic midrash, these words are recontextualized to mean something quite different from what they mean in the biblical source. The entire verse in Job reads, "There is no darkness nor shadow of death where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves." Zach, cutting off the second half of the verse, everything about the workers of iniquity, represents the bereaved God seeking in the biblical words a consoling notion that death will have no dominion. His voice, however, is faint. He really doesn't believe it. In a crescendo of repetitions of the loving epithet, Job at the end is not only a sweet servant, but the sweetest of servants, concretized in the penultimate line, each of whose eyeballs was like an Eden. That slightly odd locution, and maybe the effect is meant to be comic, is probably a transmogrification of the idiom for great affection shared by Hebrew and English, like the apple of his eye, kevavat eno, and also encouraged by the pair of alliterations, galgal ayin, gan adanim, which my translation tries to emulate with each eyeball's Eden. In the end, the gap in the biblical text that Zach's poem fills is not a matter of explanatory detail or motivation, but an emotional gap. He transforms the remote God of the book of Job into a compassionate, loving God. This deity, however, is not a loving God in any Christian sense, but instead a thoroughly humanized figure. If, in fact, he had great feelings of fondness for his servant Job, not expressed in the Bible itself, he now is inconsolable in missing him, as we ordinary humans feel when we have lost a loved one, with the added anguish that God will go on missing Job forever, because unlike the flesh and blood bereaved, his existence is without end. If the first of our three Zach poems is colloquial and the second cast in middle diction, the third is entirely biblical. Indeed, it presents a limit case for literary allusion because in its 12 lines, there is not a single word that is not a quotation from the Bible. It is a kind of tour de force, specifically from three biblical texts, which I'll turn to, Psalms, Genesis, and Job. What is remarkable is that through the simple strategy of repetition, syntactic variation, and interweaving of the three biblical texts, Zach has created a haunting original poem. "Man as the grass, his days as the grass, the days of man as the grass, his days, fear not. Man unto trouble is born unto trouble. Man is born unto trouble, is born, fear not. And the sparks fly upward, upward the sparks." And in the original, it sounds like this. "Enosh kechatzir yamav, yamav kechatzir, yemei enosh kechatzir yamav, al tira. Adam la'amal yulad, yulad la'amal, Adam yulad la'amal, yulad, al tira. Uvnei reshef yagbiu, uf, yagbiu b'nei reshef." My translation throughout, even though I have translated all the biblical texts quoted, I use the phrasing of the King James Bible because it's the one English version that will be familiar to most readers with English readers with a literary bent. The Hebrew one should say is more arrestingly compact than the English, a reflection of the powerful concision of biblical Hebrew that is difficult to reproduce in any modern Western language. The first line of the poem, just three words in Hebrew, Ad Enosh Kechatzir Yamav, is taken from Psalm 103, verse 15. The withering grass as an image of ephemerality is a poetic commonplace in the Bible and occurs with slightly different wording in Isaiah and elsewhere. The next verse in Psalm 103, which is not quoted here, continues this somber meditation on the frailty and brevity of life. I quote, "For the wind passeth over it, and it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more." The second, third, and fourth line repeat the first, merely changing the order of the words. The effect is to transform the three biblical words initially cited into a kind of mantra on mortality. The poem terms man, days, grass, round and round in a mesmerizing spell, making us deeply absorb their message of human transience. The two words of the fifth line introduce a counterpoint. Fear not, al tira, appears numerous times in the Bible, usually spoken by God in reassurance to a human being. Its first occurrence is at the beginning of Genesis 15. Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield. Al tira Avram, anochi magen lach. The speaker, confronted through the text from Psalms by the bleak terror of mortality, seeks, perhaps desperately, for consolation in these two reassuring words that appear in other biblical texts. The phrases from Psalms and Genesis are then juxtaposed for the remaining seven lines of the poem with a verse from Job 5, verse 7. Man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. Adam le'mal yulad kivnei reshef yagbiu uf. This, of course, is still another unsettling image of man's existential plight. Once again, Zach uses the strategy of repetition to produce a hypnotic intensification of the already somber biblical words. Trouble is repeated three times, and is born, which is only one word in the Hebrew, four times. The fourth repetition coming at the end of the sequence, inviting us to focus on the ill-starred condition of being born, the entering from the womb into the cycle of futility and mortality that is the lot of humankind. This bleak perspective, like the one from Psalms, also needs the urgent counterpoint of fear not. The last two lines of the poem pick up the second half of the verse from Job. There may be an implicit linkage between the image of sparks and the image of grass. Flying sparks can ignite withering grass, so that the metaphors combine turn human transience and trouble into an altogether combustible condition. The penultimate line is an exact quotation of Job, with a minuscule difference that instead of as, k, Zach has and, v. Then in the final line, he once more turns around the syntax while eliminating the verb fly, oof. The effect is a little disorienting. The sparks go up, yagbiu, but flight is denied them. And the last image of the poem is disembodied sparks going up in the void. The decision to weave man as the grass his days entirely out of phrases from the Bible is an unusual one, and its execution is, as I've said, a tour de force. It puts the book of Job with its dark sense of suffering as humanity's ineluctable fate in dialogue with the psalmist's notion of the ephemerality of human life, and then strives to set God's two-word assurance to his chosen ones against both of these. By emphatic, artful repetition, the chasm between the biblical text and the modern reader is bridged. The biblical words that constitute the poem become both the poet's and ours as readers of the poem. Zelda Azach, as I've said, is a perfectly secular poet to whom the Bible, as well as Job in particular, speaks strongly in a variety of ways, sometimes in antithesis to his own feeling and experience, and sometimes, as here, in consonance with it. I would like now to take up the instructive counterexample of a seriously devout poet. I think she's also a far greater poet than Zach, who also proves to be a boldly challenging reader of Job. Zelda, born Zelda Schneerson, 1914 to 1984, was the member of a distinguished Hasidic family, a cousin of Zalman Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, still thought by some of his followers after his death to be the Messiah. Though I doubt that Zelda ever entertained such notions about her relative, she certainly remained a pious, ultra-Orthodox woman all her life. She was also a remarkable poet with a sensibility that often seems daringly modern, not what one usually thinks of as Orthodox. It's revelatory that Amos Oz, in his autobiographical A Tale of Love and Darkness, reports that when she was his teacher in a religious elementary school in Jerusalem, she took him aside. This is the early 1940s, recognizing him as a student with literary gifts, and sat and read with the young boy Uri Tzvi Greenberg and other Hebrew modernist poets. Kind of a wacky idea, but I think it worked educationally. I think he was about 9 or 10 years old. She also had no difficulty in befriending the younger and militantly feminist poet Yonah Voloch, famous among other things for writing an erotic poem that involved the paraphernalia of male prayer at tefillin in the act of sex. Unlike the Zach poems, there are no quotations from Job, and indeed, there's no unambiguous indication that the poem has anything to do with Job until the revelation at the very end makes clear that the entire poem is a profound and illuminating response to the biblical book. And this is the last poem on your handout. The comforters come into the outer court, standing by the gate that faces the valley of the shadow of death and its terror all around. To stand by the gate is all the comforters can bear. My soul, too, is thousands of leagues from the self of the weeper. A divine decree, creator of nights. And or maybe it's better to, I might have changed that translation to, it's decreed. Yeah, that's better, I think. It's decreed. Creator of nights and wind, is not this terrible weeping before you? Be not far. That's the title line. Let not millions of light years stand as a barrier between you and Job. And let me read that in the Hebrew, which I find quite beautiful, Al Terchak. Hamenachamim ba'im el chatzer hachitzona, umdim ad yad hashar asher panav el ge tzalmavet, ve'eimato saviv saviv. Amida ad yad hashar kol yecholtam shel menachamim laset. גם נפשי במרחק פרסאות מן העני של הבוכה. גזירה היא, יוצר לילות ורוח, הלא נגדך בכי היום זה, אל תרחק, אל יעמדו כחייץ מיליוני שנות אור בינך ובין איוב. The first word of the poem, HaMenachamim, provides a minimal clue for the relation to Job, but not an unambiguous one. That is, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sofar are not actually called comforters, but rather re'im, companions or friends, but they are linked with the verb to comfort. That is, they come to Job, l'nachamo, when they first come to visit Job after all the disasters befall him. In any case, the initial setting of the poem looks distinctly contemporary, not something from the land of Utz. The house with the outer court surrounded by a gated wall sounds to me like the sort of house one would find in Me'ah Sha'arim, the prominent ultra-Orthodox quarter in Jerusalem. The speaker of the poem, evidently standing outside and looking at the comforters who appear to have come to the home of the bereaved in observance of the mourning practice of Shiva, is herself part of this contemporary scene. In the fourth and fifth line, however, Zelda effects one of the startling shifts of perspective that are characteristic of much of her poetry. Beyond the gate, there may or may not be an actual valley, but here it becomes a mythic vista, the valley of the shadow of death and its terror all around. The term for terror, eimah, is more than mere fear, and is associated in biblical usage with the awesome might of the deity and with the panic-inducing fright of devastating defeat and death. We return then to the comforters, their hesitation in standing at the gate, an expression of their incapacity to cross the chasm and enter into the anguish of the bereaved person. Here we might well begin to think of Job's comforters and their abysmal failure to understand what he has really undergone. So I say we can begin to think of that, but I think it's only till we get to the last word of the poem that we're really encouraged to do a double take and think of Job's comforters. At this point, the speaker of the poem explicitly introduces herself, defining her distance from the mourner. Pointedly, he is not called that, but rather someone weeping, habuche, not as the distance from the gate to the house, but psychologically and emotionally as thousands of leagues. And here, a small illustration of the, pardon me? Okay, the wonderful sense of the Hebrew language that Zelda exhibits. The Hebrew term she uses here inscribes a small but effective midrashic gesture, amplifying the mythic thrust of the poem, because parsaot, which has a terrible English equivalent, parasangs, but nobody knows what a parasang is. So I've rendered it as leagues, has a distinctive coloration of early rabbinic literature, that is, pasaot is a measure of distance that you will find in the Midrash. The phrase at the end of the first verse paragraph, it's decreed, gzerahi, points to a kind of theological nuance in this remarkably efficient and concise poetic vehicle. It is how a pious person, and the speaker, for all the radical doubt that she raises, is a pious person, would say, it's a way a pious person would say, well, that's the way things are, gzerahi, it's decreed. The problem is that there's something disturbing about the way things are as presumably God has determined them to be, as he has decreed. Built into human nature itself, as the speaker painfully realizes through unflinching introspection, is a kind of monadic egoism. That is, we're all trapped inside our own inner world. We may aspire to deep empathy and with others in their suffering, but each of us is imprisoned in his or her own self, unable to bridge the gap, despite the best of intentions between self and other. If this is how God has decreed things to be, one might be drawn to question the decree. This sort of questioning brings us back to the book of Job, to the behavior of the comforters, who certainly have no inkling of what's going on inside Job, and to God's own seeming impassivity. The second verse paragraph then turns directly to God. Zelda's phrasing in the first three lines of her address to God reflects the ease with which she works with traditional Hebrew while making it something quite new. The words of the poem's title, Al Tirchak, Be Not Far, occur frequently in Psalms of supplication. Again, I offer them in the King James Version as the expression of a desperate sense of abandonment by God. And here that feeling of God's being far away is given startling poetic realization. Creator of nights and wind, Yotzer Lelot Varuach, the last word could also mean spirit, sounds biblical, but it is biblical with important differences. It appears to build on an epithet for God in Amos 4:13, Yotzer Harim Uvore Ruach, shaper of mountains and creator of wind. Instead of mountains, Harim, we get Leilot, nights, in the plural. Not the night that with day constitutes the diurnal cycle, but the nights when each of us is alone with his or her fears and grief. The full force of the weeper at the end of the first verse paragraph now becomes evident. The speaker standing by the gate or outside it has been hearing a terrible sound of sobs from within the house. Can God, who we are told is merciful, remain distant from this intolerable suffering? The speaker's sense of her distance and that of the comforters from the anguish of the mourner is in the poem's second movement extrapolated to God's apparent distance. Another small verbal choice brilliantly articulates the distance as the speaker's removal at thousands of leagues becomes the divine removal at millions of light years, the midrashic and biblical frame of reference exploding into a modern scientific vision of a vast cosmos, millions of light years in breadth. And I think really only a great poet would have the boldness of imagination to put together parsaot and milyoneshnot, or leagues and millions of light years. The end of the poem, where Job's name finally appears, turns it into a searching perception of the biblical text. In the poetic debate, Job's anger and anguish are repeatedly focused on his feeling that God remains remote from him in his suffering. He would like to confront God face to face, exact from him some answer, judicial or otherwise, about why he has been subjected to such catastrophes. In Zelda's reading, God has interposed a barrier, chayetz, of millions of light years between himself and Job, and by implication between himself and every human sufferer. And the speaker, invoking the two-word phrase from the Psalms of supplication, implores God to cross that terrible distance. Al tirchak, be not far away. It is hard to imagine how a biblical text could be put to more powerful use. The poet makes Job's comforters an image of the distance of the present day comforters and her own from the bereaved person's grief. And identifying with Job, she picks up Job's desperate sense of a vast, unspannable chasm between himself and the God who he feels must somehow be responsible for what has befallen him. It should be evident from these examples how the book of Job, the plot of its frame story, the substance of its poetic argument, bits of its language, become a rich resource for both these modern Hebrew poets. Intertextuality, moreover, as has often been observed, is a two-way street. The poets exploiting the biblical text in unanticipated ways also end up throwing light on it. Job has been the object of endless philological analysis and of literary and theological interpretation, at least some of it even instructive. But one might argue that certain aspects of the ancient text become most urgently alive through the modern literary remakings of it. In the exemplary instance of Moby Dick, Melville understood and made us see with far greater penetration than the scholars the radical implications of the rejection in the book of Job of the anthropocentric view of creation. Zach's three poems respectively illuminate the contrast between the high drama of Job's suffering and the banality of our everyday equivalent, the missing element of divine compassion in God's reported relationship with his favorite servant, and the full frightening power of the Job poet's vision of human life as restless trouble, transience, and instability. Zelda's poem helps us to understand more keenly the existential isolation that is inseparable from Job's suffering. The friends who ostensibly come to console him have no access at all to his zone of anguish, and the God to whom he addresses his pleas remains remote, hidden, inscrutable. Any foundational literary work continues to live most amply in its imaginative interpretations and transformations by later writers. And these two modern Hebrew poets directly engaged in the book of Job in its original language make that vividly clear in their poems. Thank you. I would be happy to, oh, I guess I don't need this. I'd be happy to attempt to answer your questions. Yes.
I was curious in your translation of, I was curious in your translation of Zelda that you didn't play with the connection with Kamir Chak and Al Tir Chak. And I kind of wonder why you made the decision of the thousands of leagues rather than something that played with the do not be far.
That played with the what?
I'm sorry, in the...
I understood the first part of your question, but not the second.
Okay. The line where you translate my soul too is thousands of leagues, and it's Gam Nafshi Merchak, Parsaot, and that Merchak seems to play so strongly with the Altir Chak. And I was just curious why you made that decision.
Well, I suppose that let me, well, I want to flip to the text just a moment. I guess I felt that the I could have put far in, far off from. It seemed to me a little bit almost clunky. There are too many syllables in there. I wanted to be more compact. So that was my decision, but I'll think about it. Oh, did you have a second question? No, oh, okay. Yeah.
I have also...
Yaakov, yeah.
I also have a... First of all, thank you. Enjoyed it very much. I have a translation question also, and one other that isn't. First of all, why Satan? Or why not Satan and adversary?
Oh, that's an easy answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I'll answer that, then you ask your second question. Because the traditional, even though I use phrases from the King James Version, because the traditional English translation of the Bible translate Hasatan as Satan, we've gotten into a fix, because Satan conveys to the English reader a figure with horns and a tail holding a pitchfork. And of course, Hasatan, and he's not called Satan, it's not a name, it's a function, Hasatan. He is someone whose function is liot mastin, that is to create obstacles, to raise objections. So I sort of religiously follow the principle of translating it as the adversary. Okay, that was an easy one.
Yeah, okay. This might be easy as well. Your talk is about appropriation or about allusions to the Bible, and I wanted to ask you about a phenomena that's only in the second song, Lifamim Mitgagea, where he uses quotation marks to quote, "There is no darkness nor shadow of death."
Yeah.
He uses quotation marks. How do you see that as denoting this is a quotation from the Bible in contrast with all of the other biblical references which aren't quoted?
Well, I guess that he wanted it to be very clear to the readers that this was a quotation. And I think I didn't use quotation marks, but I used italics, which does the same job. So that's just a mechanical problem.
But also, this is a quote in the moment of the poem. He recites to himself in a faint voice.
Right.
That, I mean, the quotation marks are not indicating that it's a citation, but rather that he is... reciting it.
So he's speaking, right. That's good. There's somebody over here.
Oh, wow. One for Jan. Thank you. You had mentioned Yehuda Amichai as perhaps the greatest of the poets. I don't know if his era or in general. Sure. Did he sort of busy himself with Job?
There are a couple of poems that either episodically or obliquely allude to Job, but for some reason, he doesn't use Job a lot. I mean, he has many poems on the biblical... Saul, on David, he has a wonderful, I strongly recommend it to you, a cycle of poems called The Visit of the Queen of Sheba, which is very exuberant. Some of it is quite erotic and sort of ingenious. It's been translated not badly, but the Hebrew is such a virtuoso display of puns and sound play and so forth. He wrote about Solomon, he wrote about all kinds, but not much about Job.
The phrase at the end, milione shnot or, that can be translated, I presume, as millions of years of light, which is different from light years.
No, shnoto means light years. Doesn't it? I never studied astronomy in Hebrew. When somebody said shnoto, doesn't it mean light?
Shnoto always is the distance light travels.
Yeah. It's a set phrase in Hebrew.
Why do you suppose it's an expression, it's an idiom. Steeped in Orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Would introduce such a modern technical idea as this in measured in life.
Well, because she was a poet. You can also ask the question, why would a pious woman steeped in orthodoxy challenge God in the way that she does? I mean, first, there are a number of things that make her a poet of the first order. One is being absolutely honest with herself and her perception of the world. And there are poems she's written on Psalms, which are also arguments. So there's that utter honesty. There's never a moment of posturing in Zelda. I think that not in the poems that I presented tonight, but in many Zach poems, there is posturing. So that's one thing. The other thing is that a poet makes use of whatever materials work for his or her purposes and is not limited by the frame of reference of orthodoxy or Me'ah Shearim or anything. Well, I'll give you a biblical example, actually. I think the greatest of all biblical poets is the Job poet. And he has the most inventive metaphors of any poet in the Bible. I mean, he borrows metaphors from weaving, metaphors from curdling cheese. And I'm fully convinced if there were bicycles in the biblical period, there would be a bicycle metaphor in the book of Job. So she's not different in that respect. Yes.
Thank you. And thank you for the wonderful discussion and these four marvelous poems to study. I wanted to go back to, for Job, it was a one-time thing, and ask you to explicate that a little more.
Okay.
If I could give my own little summary.
Yeah.
As an introduction to yours. So for Job, it was a one-time thing. It's kind of ironic, because here you have this heroic, tragic figure experiencing something overwhelming.
Right.
And then it's over, according to the poet. Whereas for the rest of us, for me, the poet, which I'm, and I think he's talking about all of us.
Okay, sure.
There's nothing tragic or heroic about our little miseries. They just go on and on and on.
Right, and they're repetitious.
And repetitious. So could you discuss that a little more, or do I have it?
Okay, well... one of the features of tragedy as a literary expression of the human condition is that it has a linear plot that doesn't keep circling around and around. Like Oedipus... only kills his father once, and presumably he sleeps with his mother more than once, but it's not a matter of repetition, but of continual activity. And then he only blinds himself once, and that's the, in a very crude terms, that's the tragic plot of Oedipus. So he's saying that we're denied this kind of literary shapeliness in our own lives, that is, our own lives are not a plot. I think it was E.M. Forster who says something about that a plot leads somewhere where events that are plotless are just one damn thing after another. And that's the way our lives are, the one damn thing after another, which then tend to be repetitious. And it's repetition on a scale of banality. So that's what I would say.
I wanted to ask when the Zach poems were, because I don't know if you said it and I missed it, but if you could date them, because one of the things that I've noticed both with the conversation yesterday with Meir Shalev in the evening and with your paper today, that there is this pattern of describing men later in their lives reflecting back in a very kind of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes sense of what has passed and what has gone before us and what was it really worth. And yet none of these people... none of the modern writers are really quoting Kohelet, which I find an almost ironic absent text in what's going on. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on both because of the timing of when Natan Zach is working.
Yeah, the why Kohelet is not quoted. Yeah.
And also whether these are later poems for Natan Zach or earlier poems.
They're not very early, but they're also not... recent poems, and let me remind that Zach now is 82, going on 83, and I think that these poems date from the late 60s and the 70s, so they're sort of the middle of his career. Mm. Why he didn't use Kohelet, I don't know. He was focusing on Job, and that might have pushed Kohelet back to the periphery of his vision.
Because Zelda's poem, I mean, Zelda's most famous poem, really engages with the Kohelet story. And yesterday when Meir was talking about Jacob sort of getting really kvetchy towards the end.
Yeah.
It's sort of something I've been thinking about in response to these two conversations.
Yeah, although these poems don't feel to me quite like an older man's retrospective reflection in somber colors on his whole life. You know, they're much more, the first and the third poem are much more kind of existential reflections on what it's like to be a human being. And the second one is a sort of a polemic, exegetical engagement with the Book of Job. And there's much to polemicize against in the Book of Job. So I don't see these necessarily as poems of old age. I know you have in the back of your mind the fact that according to the Midrash, King Solomon of blessed memory, when he was a young man, wrote the Song of Songs, and when he attained the wisdom of middle age, wrote his Book of Proverbs, and then in the gloomy old age, wrote Kohelet.
So hi, thank you, first of all, for this inspiring talk. I just have a small observation.
Sure.
I think, I believe there's a similarity between the Eretz Acheret, the other country, in the first Zach song, and the Tehillim in the second. It seems like Eretz Acheret Sham Lo Yada Ish Et Shmi VeElohim VaSatan Lo Itcharu Beneihem Al Tzidkati, and then in Tehillim, בדברים כל כך מרגיעים, כל כך הרבה שירים, ים גדול, ורחב ידיים ואין מספר חיות, and so on and so forth. So it's something...
I don't see what the similarity is.
So it's something of a comfort that was maybe in the past reachable or somewhere else. That someone, someone, it's like heaven is accessible in a sense, but one chose... to turn its back to it. So there's a tragedy there. in one, the tragedy of the man, and in the second, the tragedy of God, who didn't realize the moment in Tehillim in which he was actually present. And he has to read it in order to understand it again or feel it all over again. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, that's interesting. I like the idea of his reading for consolation. That is, reading the Bible can do two things. There are these words of consolation which you recite to yourself to make yourself feel better in a terribly bitter reality. There's a wonderful poem, maybe some of you remember it, by Yehuda Amichai, called Erev Kayetz Bachalon Im Tehillim, where he imagines all 150 Mizmorim of the Book of Psalms marching in front of his window, and he recalls the phrases Me Menuchot and something else, and he says, but where do we really find these in our world? So that's similar. But it's interesting. The reading of the Bible can either give you a kind of temporary and inefficacious sense of consolation, or because there are many troubling things expressed in the Bible as Adam Lemal Yulad, they can really trouble you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I wonder why you use God, or sometimes he misses instead of sometimes he longs.
That's as we say a judgment call. Like, you know, in modern Hebrew, you say, you know, you write your sweetie and you say, "Ani mitgagei elach." It can mean, you know, I miss you, or I long for you, and you just say, "What?"
I miss you.
Yeah, I miss you, but I think the primary meaning is miss. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Where he says, Zach, and on Friday, two blows to pay your dues, and on Saturday you rest and recover. Is this, you know, two blows is a two loaves of bread?
It's Shabbat. Something like that. You get two smacks and then you rest on Shabbat.
This is because God doesn't work on Saturday, so he gives him two blows on Friday.
Exactly, because he doesn't work on Saturday.
One is for Saturday.
It's humorous in an interesting way, I think.
But I think we should also notice the kind of blows Nathan Zach is complaining about, to see how spoiled and
oh yes,
he is. Right. He's like a nagging little child, you know, because he complains about a little bruise or a black eye. This can be really bothering, but then it is forms to fill, or the landlord, or work, or letters, or a woman in the evening. And you see this also, the attitude towards the woman. She's one of these bothering
things
around you. He's very egocentric, very spoiled.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
And this comes out from this poem.
Okay, I buy that. That is... the poem works well enough, but you could describe it as a kind of poetic fetch,
yeah,
which is not necessarily poetry of the first order. Yeah.
But to continue this thought in the third stanza, He says, then I went to another country and nobody knew me and everything was simple and wonderful, although boring, but it wasn't right. And then he says, so I went back to my place, my home, and he says, I'm a prophet. Look, pay attention to me. I want to be kicky. I want to be like Job. Mm-hmm. Me, you know, I want to be like Job. It's very peculiar. What do you think about that?
Well, no. That is what you could, following Mayu's suggestion, you could say that it's a little pretentious to call yourself a prophet if what that means is that they run a full-page interview of you in Yediot or whatever. But the me at the end, that says, you know, I don't want to be bothered by public obligations and roles as a cultural figure. I just want to be me. It's sort of unresolved because in some way he probably likes being a prophet.
Everybody's looking very tired, especially our participants. Yeah. I don't want to have lirachem aleh. I want to lirachem. But I just wanted to say, if I could, a plug for a philological, pedantic sort of plug. But I really like parasangs, and I don't know how parasangs parsaot, the Persian term parasang, and I just thought this was nice because it ties some things together we've been talking about throughout the symposium, that the in the Midrash it talks about Jacob's ladder as being 8,000. The Talmudic term is parsaot, 8,000 parasangs from the ground to the sky. So I just thought that was a nice thing, and also the Gzerahi in Zelda's poem. Yeah. I was recalling, and I looked at. I just wanted to check. We were talking earlier about Shmuel HaNagid, and there's the Gzerahi. He has a very famous poem, Gzerahi, which reads, Gzerahi tmuta al gvarim, v'lachen yasu zakim sfarim, drosh oti v'im amut drosh min sfarai, chok umisifrei yesharim, which I think is very beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she was aware of it, but it's a beautiful tie in, I think, in terms of mortality, human mortality as well.
Well, I realize that, say, historically and philologically, I suppose one could translate, be justified in translating parsaot as parasangs. The problem is that this is a poem, and parasangs means nothing, I would say, to 85% of fairly literate English readers.
What about parsaot? Does parsaot ring? Does it?
Yeah.
You can use it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much, everybody, for coming out. Thank you. I wanted to thank again, our sponsor, our angel, Rita Rosenberg, without whose help this conference would not have come off. She came through at a difficult time for us and supplied us the funds to make the conference happen, as well as the library, Jewish Studies, and most of all, for all of you for being here. Thank you to our participants who came from all over the world, literally, many parasangs away. And I want to
there is
person. And there's an amazing looking dessert. Please don't leave without having some dessert. Some of which, if some of you who keep kosher, some of them are milchik desserts, just their signs saying they're dairy or not. And thank you again. It's been a wonderful time together. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.